in Portland. Again, that's Giants of Jazz and Blues, a benefit concert for the American Music Program. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Enemigo Imperialismo, Enemy Imperialism, a bilingual community art exhibit that explores the dimensions of imperialism in the world today. The opening of this art show will be Friday, September 5th at 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, 1001 Southeast Division Street in Portland. Artists around the world have responded to violence with work that questions the legitimacy of the state and empire. Enemigo Imperialismo points to one of our common targets in the fight for global justice and invites us to reflect on power, resistance, and self-determination. Again, that's Enemigo Imperialismo. The opening of this art show will be Friday, September 5th at 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, 1001 Southeast Division Street in Portland. The show will be up until September 25th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community.
On September 8th, the UV-746 tugboat is broadcasting live from 7 to 8 p.m. with a crew of authors, musicians, and performers.
That train, when it came in, it was going pretty fast.
Featuring the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
It's a glass of water out of one of those springs.
New histories of old folk music.
And sprinkle a little lemon juice in it.
Train hopping, wobblies, and the Great Depression. Told from the utopia of cigarette trees where the cops have wooden legs. At 7 p.m., the tugboat on the Willamette lights up for a special one-time broadcast. Listen in at 90.7 KBOO and find out more at steamradiosyndicate.com.
Hey, Sarah, have you ever tried acupuncture?
You know, I really would love to try acupuncture, but I never seem to have the time, and I just don't know who to go to.
Well, you should come with me to A Touch of Portland 2014, Sunday, September 7th, from noon to 8 p.m. KBOO Community Radio and Sante Aesthetics are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. Heard of Taste of Portland? Well, Touch of Portland is a twist on that idea and allows you to sample different healing modalities from local practitioners in your community. It's a KBOO benefit that focuses on the healing arts. It gives participants a chance to sample multiple healing modalities in a comfortable setting and in 10 to 30 minute increments. This year is exciting as we will be hosting a block party with an 8-hour live broadcast right from the event Sunday, September 7th, on Northwest 17th, between Davis and Everett.
That sounds great. I would love to go check out Touch of Portland. So where can I find more information?
kboo.fm/touchofportland.
The time is now 5:03 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Senate prepares to vote on a constitutional amendment that would overturn the Citizens United Court decision that declared corporations to have the same rights as people.
Activists gather in Ferguson, Missouri to call for the replacement of a prosecutor assigned to the case of a white officer who shot an unarmed black teenager last month.
We'll hear about local efforts to bring attention to a repressive law that targets animal rights activists and labels them as terrorists.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 5th, 2014. I'm Paul Rowland.
And I'm Kristen Yount. On Monday, the U.S. Senate will vote on whether or not to overturn the Supreme Court's decision regarding Citizens United. The judgment in the Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission case found that political spending is protected under the First Amendment, and governments can't stop unions or corporations from spending money on ads and pooling their monies into political action groups, specifically to draw support to a particular candidate. Historically, First Amendment rights applied to individual people. Since the Supreme Court ruling, billions of corporate dollars have gone into political campaigns around the country. In fact, Citizens United website boasts a new study called The Business of American Democracy, Citizens United, Independent Spending, and Elections, which reported that since Citizens United v. FEC 4 years ago, Republicans are 6 percentage points more likely to be elected into office than Democrats because Democrats are outspent. The ruling ascertains that when corporations donate money to political campaigns, they are exercising free speech. The bill grants Congress and the states the power to regulate the raising and spending of money and in-kind equivalents with respect to federal and state elections, respectively. 50 senators indicated that they would vote in favor of overturning the ruling. That means to ratify the amendment, 17 more senators need to vote to attain a two-thirds majority needed to ratify that. Groups like MoveOn.org urged voters to appeal to senators to vote yes on Monday. Once it passes in the Senate, a 3/4 majority must be reached in the United States House of Representatives.
Dozens of fast food workers were arrested in Detroit, Cleveland, Chicago, and other cities yesterday, calling for a living wage. They are demanding $15 an hour, which McDonald's employee Carrie Terry says is not unreasonable, since she is trying to raise a family on her fast food employee wage.
County Prosecutor McCullough's house right now. Unfortunately, he's not home, but we've left several heartfelt letters to tell him that we would really appreciate if he would allow us to appoint a special prosecutor to Mike Brown's case. The people of Ferguson have lost faith in the county being able to prosecute this fairly, and it's imperative that he listen to that. They have asked him to recuse himself from the case, and I think that's the ethical thing to do. That's the empathetic thing to do, and that's the right thing to do to move forward towards healing in this community.
How are you doing? What's going on here?
My name is Tara.
Yeah.
I'm from Houston, Texas.
All right.
And we're in the neighborhood today to
for
ask,
what? For what reason?
To ask Bob McCullough's neighbors if he would please help us ask the governor to ask him to step down from Michael Brown's case.
Okay. People around here, you know,
it's a private street. There's children, and they shouldn't come to the street. You know, right now?
No.
It's like, that's an issue with Bob, who just happened to be a neighbor, in my opinion. It's not an issue with us, me, you know, anybody else.
Do you have a problem with people when they go canvassing during election time?
Never.
Yeah, the person that myself and Charles, also from Los Angeles, spoke with was a older white woman. She lived two houses down from Prosecutor McCullough. It was pretty quick where she started to say, you know, I know what's going on, and seemed more than a little bit disturbed about it. And then we asked there at the end, well, if you do feel that it would be a conflict of interest for you to speak out in some way against what your neighbor is doing, perhaps you could speak to Bob about how much you do care about your city and you do care about what's happening to marginalized folks here. And instead of just talking about the weather, or maybe you talk about the time that you shared with two people from Los Angeles who came here specifically to ask Bob to recuse himself because we felt like his role in this case could be problematic. And she didn't answer us. So.
Three. Black Lives Matter.
I am sharper than a switchblade, first and last of all. God made it, that's the truth. But man, keep on trying to hold me back.
So that was Black Lives Matter. Activists from across the country converged in Ferguson, Missouri this week as part of Black Lives Matter Coalition. The group canvassed in several neighborhoods in St. Louis County to call for the replacement of the prosecutor assigned to the case of Darren Wilson, the Ferguson police officer who shot and killed 18-year-old Michael Brown on August 8th. They say that the prosecutor assigned to the case, Bob McCullough, should be replaced by a special prosecutor from outside the area who will be able to look at the facts of the case more objectively. Some of the activists actually went to McCullough's house as they canvassed in his neighborhood and placed heartfelt letters at his door. You heard about that in the audio. That, again, was Black Lives Matter. It's a group that joined forces with the newly formed Don't Shoot Coalition, which is a new alliance of St. Louis organizers and leaders. And now we go back to the fast food story.
The call for a $15 an hour minimum wage has seen the most support in the city of Seattle, where Socialist City Councilor Kashama Sawant managed to get the council to pass a measure that moves the city to a $15 an hour minimum wage in the next 5 years. Sawant spoke to KBOO Radio about this issue today.
Kind of hard because it put me in a position where I have to choose to put gas in my car or to buy my son diapers and wipes. To choose between to get them back, to get to work, or make sure my kids have school clothes.
Capitalism creates conditions which force people to go into struggle. But at the same time, the scale of the struggles, the nature of the movements, whether or not they have a chance at success, how they assess the balance of forces, whether they're going to be able to succeed in fighting the might of the ruling class. None of this is a given. None of this is automatic. But there was always that potential for $15 an hour. And what's happened yesterday is the next stage of what has happened in Seattle, because Seattle in many ways has shown that if there is a conscious grassroots leadership, there is a conscious building of a movement, and you know, you sort of turn the tide by changing mass opinion, then there is the potential for a sweeping social change. And I think that $15 an hour has that potential. It has a lot to do with the nature of the economy under capitalism today as well. If you look at the kind of jobs that are being generated, they are the kind of jobs like you were just describing, you know, a few minutes earlier you were saying how if vast sections of the working class are able to have a decent standard of living, then they can have a different kind of life where they actually have time with their family, they have time to cook food for their children, they have time to engage in the community, they have time to engage in political activism should they choose to do so. So, you know, the economy is now in such crisis that 2/3 of the jobs that are being created are low-wage jobs. So certainly for the younger generation, people who are now graduating out of high school, people who are in their 20s, people who are in their 30s, there is no option but to move into struggle. It's not just the question of low-wage jobs. It's the question of student debt that's over $1 trillion. There is no prospect for most, except for the most privileged, you know, the upper middle class and the wealthy. For most young people, there is no prospect of going to college without taking on an insurmountable burden, financial burden. You're never going to pay back that loan of $50,000, $70,000, in some cases $100,000, with a low-wage job. You know, it's hard enough with a high-paid job to repay that kind of loan. And then on top of that, there's a crisis of, climate change and the crisis of sustainability. So all of these are now, attacking the stability that the capitalist class would like to see. And, you know, that stability is now more and more being threatened. And so the $15 an hour struggle is not only important in itself. I mean, it is, because, as you said, it really will bring in a substantial improvement to the living standards, the quality of life that workers face. And these are the workers, again, as you said, you know, these are the workers that make the cities run. So this is the least that they deserve. They deserve a lot more. But the struggle for 15 is a lot more than that. First of all, it's a precursor of the times we are heading into. It's a sign of things to come. We are heading into an era of massive social movements. We're already seeing that kind of a shift in Europe and in many other countries. You know, the recent mass rebellion in Brazil during the Soccer World Cup tournament, that's also an indication, but you're starting to see that in the U.S. as well. The other thing that the $15 an hour thing has going for it is that we've had a victory in Seattle, a taste of victory is critical for movement, especially fledgling movement. You know, we're just starting, and it's important to have a sense that if we fight, we can win. And that, and the experience of having had one victory and the experience of going into a class struggle, that itself elevates the working class, elevates the confidence of the working class to ask itself, you know, where should we be going from here? You know, it raises the potential for working class people to have the audacity to say, no, we refuse to accept this agenda of inequality. But at the end of the day, I think we have to remember that even $15 an hour, as massive as the struggle has to be for 15 to win nationwide, it is not going to be the solution for the deep crisis that capitalism is in. And so we're going to have to engage in much more far-reaching struggle. And the struggle for 15 is, we should think of it not only as important in itself, which it is, but also as the preparatory stage, you know, stages where we can learn from, movements can learn from our mistakes and move forward to much bigger upheavals, which will not only have the corporate media stacked against us, or, you know, a mayor here or a council member there who will be fighting for corporate loopholes, but we will have a much more overt might of the working of the capitalist class against us. It will be this is what class struggle looks like. It will be a class war. There already has been a war on the living standards of the working class. The question is, are we going to be able to change the balance of forces? And I think the state that the global economy is in should tell everybody that there is no option, there is no time to lose. We have to urgently move into struggle.
And that was Seattle Socialist City Council Councilor Kashama Sawant speaking to KBOO today about the fight for a $15 an hour minimum wage for all workers.
Tomorrow in Portland, a coalition of organizations have organized an event called In the Face of Repression, Organizing in Spite of the Surveillance State. The event is part of a National Day of Action to fight the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, an 8-year-old law that has been used to target animal rights and environmental activists for long prison terms. For more, KBOO's Jinka Soderberg spoke with Tim Hitchens of Resistance Ecology, one of the organizers of the event.
Tim, I wonder if you could start out by telling us what is the event tomorrow, and where and when is it taking place?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. So the name of the event tomorrow is called In the Face of Repression, Organizing in Spite of the Surveillance State. And basically it's a day of workshops and history lessons, and most of all, solidarity. This weekend is a National Weekend of Action Against the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which is a horrible draconian law that was passed within the past few years thanks to the help of the American Legislative Exchange Council that has horribly targeted animal rights activists unjustly. And there are currently two activists who are dealing with the repercussions of this law being passed and are dealing with an indictment of this of the AETA, as it's known. Operation Backfire was a nationally coordinated effort on the part of the government and the state to really go after the quote-unquote extreme elements of the animal rights and environmental movement by arresting and indicting a large group of Animal Liberation Front, Earth Liberation Front activists who were outed by a snitch and really throwing down the hammer on them. Some of the prosecutorial measures that were used against these activists when they were in trial were so extremely harsh, were blatant overreach of their powers, and basically the state used Operation Backfire to really try to not only drive a wedge in between the more radical elements of the animal rights and environmental movement with the mainstream, but also to try and strike fear into activists' hearts that if you are willing to take any form of direct action, that you will pay a serious price.
Now, earlier this week, we reported on a judge's ruling in Idaho against a so-called ag gag rule that was passed by the state legislature there to prevent animal rights activists from carrying out undercover investigations of animal abuses. Does that seem to be part of this agenda that you're talking about by the American Legislative Exchange Council and others to demonize or to delegitimize animal rights activism?
Absolutely. The ag gag is just one component of this broader brute force campaign to try and silence successful animal rights and environmental campaigns. The reason the ag gag legislation, which is pushed through by ALEC as well, state by state, has really come to the news so much lately is, one, it's new, and two, because it's so outlandish, it's easier for people to grasp how terrible it is. And essentially what the people that are promoting these ag gag bills in each state want is to turn simple undercover investigations and filming of the horrific, horrific conditions that take place on factory farms across the country and the world for that matter, but here in our country, and turning that into a form of terrorism. And really because they just... these people don't want to show what is actually happening at factory farms, because if most people knew, they would stop buying their products, and their products are meat, dairy, eggs.
I don't know if your group is going to be making the connection this weekend, but over the past month, I think the United States has been engaged in a national dialogue about racism and police violence that has been brought to light by the events in Ferguson, Missouri. And as a mainly white movement, the animal rights activists and environmental activists have faced some of what people of color have faced in this country for many, many years. And I suppose that's what you're getting at when you say the connection of these struggles has to be made.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, again, historically, animal rights activists have come from positions of privilege and are predominantly white. That is changing, and groups like Resistance Ecology and many other grassroots groups out there are really trying to challenge the dominant culture that exists within the animal rights movement, which has continued to isolate itself by not making the connections and recognizing that it can come from a position of privilege, and that going vegan may not be the answer for everyone. And so events like this are kind of perfect to draw the parallels between our communities.
Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Tim Hitchens with Resistance Ecology. He's one of the organizers of the event that is being held tomorrow called In the Face of Repression, Organizing in Spite of Government Surveillance, which will be at Portland State University, the Smith Memorial Student Union, September 6th, beginning at 12 noon. So it will be going from noon till about 4 in the afternoon there at Portland State University on Saturday, September 6th. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO Radio.
A British judge has authorized the extradition to the U.S. of a mentally ill man accused of conspiring to set up a terrorism training camp in Oregon in 2002. Last year, a European court had ruled that Haroun Aswat could not be extradited because of his mental condition. He has been treated in a secure psychiatric hospital for paranoid schizophrenia. After U.S. officials promised to continue his treatment during imprisonment in the U.S., a British judge ruled yesterday that the extradition could be carried out. The decision means that British citizen Haroun Aswat can now face trial on conspiracy charges in the U.S. He's accused of conspiring with radical cleric Mustafa Kamel Mustafa to set up a terrorist training camp in Bly, Oregon, over a decade ago. Prosecutors have linked Aswat to Mustafa, long prominent in the British media because of his fiery sermons at London's Finsbury Park Mosque. Mustafa was extradited nearly 2 years ago and convicted in New York in May of terrorism charges. He has not yet been sentenced. Aswat, believed to be in his late 30s, had been fighting extradition since his arrest on a U.S. warrant in 2005. He is also expected to face trial in New York.
Five immigrant rights advocates have been charged with lynching for participating in a protest in California in July. A judge today upheld the charge, even though the way it is being used by California prosecutors is far different than the original intent of the law. The anti-lynching law prevents anyone from taking someone out of the custody of the police. This was apparently meant to prevent mobs from pulling someone charged with a crime away from police to carry out some kind of mob justice against them. But the law is vague and defines lynching as, quote, two or more persons acting together to take a person from the lawful custody of a police officer, end quote. In this case, police allege that university student Janet Matheson was being taken into custody by police when she was pulled away by four other activists. All five have now been hit with the felony lynching charge. But Matheson's account of the incident and video footage taken at the scene shows that even the police claim that activists pulled her away from an officer is completely false. At the protest, which took place in Murrieta, California, immigrant rights advocates faced off against anti-immigration protesters, including some known white supremacists. At one point, the anti-immigration protesters began to shout homophobic slurs at the pro-immigration group. And one of the immigrant rights advocates found herself surrounded by the counter-protesters who were shouting her down, pushing her, and belittling her. Matheson then stepped in to try to get her friend out of that situation, and an officer came up and asked her what had happened. She started to explain. The officer began to grab her. Matheson then linked arms with four other demonstrators and backed away, saying loudly, we are leaving, to try and get back across the line between the two demonstrations. All five were then arrested and charged with lynching. After reviewing the evidence, the Riverside County District Attorney's Office decided that the charge was appropriate. The five activists were arraigned this week and will have a trial on the charges in coming months.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Today in history, on September 5th, 1774, the First Continental Congress assembled at Carpenter's Hall in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. An Ohio man has been charged with obstruction of justice and falsification after lying about being shot by three black men in the parking lot of a shopping center. Christopher Heben is a former Navy SEAL and mercenary soldier who got a lot of publicity out of his story, claiming that he, a white man, was attacked and shot by a car full of black men in a parking lot. His false accusations were promoted by right-wing media, playing into stereotypes about aggressive black men attacking defenseless white men. Here's a clip of Christopher Heben talking to a right-wing radio station in Ohio.
You know, like I said, I'm capable of handling myself. A matter of fact, if three guys come up to me in a bar, that first guy is inconsequential to me. I'm already looking through that dude to the other guys behind him. I've identified the exits. I'm gonna strike fast, strike hard, leave some bodies on the floor, and get the hell out of there.
Yeah,
that's pretty much how I was trained. So I'm walking back to my car. I get my wallet. And I continue back to the store, and he re-engages me, pulls up next to me around the same spot where we had the initial conversation, pretty damn close. So I'm still far from the store.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, hey, you know, you need to learn some respect, whitey, blah, blah, blah. You know, you got a big ass mouth, all this stuff. And I said, well, you know, where I come from, respect is earned. It's not issued. And I'd be happy to, you know, give you a chance to earn that right now if you're, you know, if so inclined or something like that. He looks to his buddy, looks back at me, and then I felt this massive impact to like my left lower abdomen, like mule kick, took my breath away, doubled me over.
You feel it before you even hear the gunshot.
Oh yeah. Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Okay.
When you figure, right, it's, you know, faster than the speed of sound, right?
Yeah.
So it's hitting you before you, you know.
Problem is, the whole story was a lie, according to local investigators. Heben did show up at the hospital with a gunshot wound, but surveillance video of the shopping center shows that he was never there, and the altercation he described did not happen. He may have been trying to get publicity for a new online series called The Mercenaries that he's participating in. Here's a clip of Heben from the marketing video for the series, which was posted on YouTube.
For the first time, they are willing to release some of the internal footage from actual missions and allow new high-tech cameras to follow on future missions. Chris Heben has worked for all of these companies, and by any measure, he is an American hero.
The contractor's roles today is increasing exponentially because of this threat from terrorism abroad. There's going to be situations that we're thrown into, and it's going to be cutting-edge equipment, cutting-edge tactics you have never seen before to serve and protect our country. It's going to be a behind-the-scenes look at former special operators from the Army, the Navy, the Marines, guys who were trained to the tip of perfection by our government.
Each week, he will be our guide on a new mission, using internal helmet and body cameras provided by the mercenaries, as well as letting us into pre-planning and post-mortem sessions.
Regardless of his motives for lying about being shot by a group of black men, the mercenary, Christopher Heben, will now face prosecution on several charges for lying to police and making up the story.
A white police officer in Oklahoma has been charged with sexually assaulting six black women. 27-year-old Daniel Holtzclaw has been charged with 16 felonies, including two counts of rape and multiple counts of sexual violence against women, all of them black. He reportedly carried out the rapes and assaults while on duty as an officer, and the other police on the force helped to cover up his crimes. Holtzclaw's case has brought to the forefront the issue of racially motivated